Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With me now, Michelle Alexander, the renowned legal scholar and author of the highly influential book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She is joining the faculty of the Union Theological Seminary here in New York for a five-year visiting professor position. Michelle Alexander joins me now, along with Union Theological Seminary President, Dr. Serene Jones. Welcome, both of you. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Professor Alexander, you're a civil rights lawyer and legal scholar. What's your connection to a theological seminary?
Well, it is a surprising move in many ways. I was not raised in a church, and I would never have predicted, even, you know, 5-10 years ago, that I might find myself attending or teaching at a theological seminary. But, you know, in my work over the years, particularly the last few years, traveling the country, attempting to raise consciousness about the human rights nightmare that is unfolding, mass incarceration in the United States, I've come to work with many, many faith communities that are taking seriously the moral and spiritual dimensions of this crisis and not just the policy dimensions of it. And about a year or so ago, I was invited to speak at Union by Serene Jones, and was just so moved by the spirit of the place and impressed by the history of that organization in, you know, really wrestling with the most profound kind of issues of social and racial justice. And I gave a speech during my visit where I really called on students at Union to provide a desperately needed moral voice as we have become the most punitive nation in the world, locking up record numbers of human beings, overwhelmingly poor people and people of color, and also deporting record numbers of human beings, overwhelmingly poor people and people of color. And as I see it, this is not simply a policy problem or a problem of power and politics. These crises, I believe, force us as a nation to look ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves questions that are moral and spiritual ones about who we are as a nation, who we are as individuals, and what kind of people and what kind of nation we ultimately want to become.
Dr. Jones, for listeners who have heard the iconic name, Union Theological Seminary, but don't really know what you do, what kind of seminary is it? Are you preparing students for a certain kind of Christian ministry?
Well, the seminary is getting close to its 200th anniversary, and what we do now is very different than what we did when we started. At the beginning, we were mainly training Protestant ministers who were going into big pulpits, primarily in New York City, most of them white, most of them male. And from that starting point, we have evolved over the years to, because I think in large part our location in New York City and our deep theological commitments to engaging the world have evolved with each generation to be really the platform for progressive religious voices in the United States speaking out to public issues. So at the turn of the century, we had the leading biblical scholars that began to break with traditional ways of reading scripture, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Paul Tillich, Reinhold Niebuhr, of course, the most quoted theologian of presidents in the United States. And into the 60s, black theology began here, womanist theology, more lately queer theology, and on the list goes. We've also become increasingly an interfaith seminary with a Buddhist program and a Muslim program. But what has remained steady across all these changes is a real, not just political, although it's a deeply political, but more than political commitment to addressing the spiritual issues of the age. As Michelle said so beautifully, when our country moves into the kind of moral crisis it's in right now with respect to mass incarceration, mass deportation, and a longer list, we have to look at ourselves and ask questions about what do we think the meaning of our life is and who are we that we have created and are sustaining such horrific institutions. And those are theological questions.
Professor Alexander, I see you'll co-teach a course called Spirit of Justice Towards an Interfaith Theology of Liberation. What might the syllabus be like for that course? Or what might be, for our listeners who might be interested in what you would recommend but aren't going to be your students, what might be on the reading list?
Well, I hesitate to share the reading list just yet because the course is a work in progress. But one of the things that I will be doing is using a blog that I'm developing and, you know, social media, Facebook and the like, to share, you know, my own journey along the way, to share what I'm reading and thinking about and some of the conversations that I'm having along the way, because I hope that, you know, these are questions we can all be asking ourselves and wrestling with, not in the privacy of our own homes and not simply through social media, but coming together in circles and in spaces of faith and in barbershops, on street corners, wrestling with these deep questions. Because I think anyone who's paying attention to the electoral cycle, the presidential election, can sense that as a nation we're in a state of crisis. Our politics are corrupt. There is an enormous number of people who are willing to vote and support explicit forms of bigotry. I think we have to pause and take account of who we are individually and collectively as a nation, who we've been, and where we want to go. And I think those who imagine that these conversations can be addressed meaningfully in halls of power and courtrooms and that ordinary people don't really have a role are deeply misguided. And one of the reasons I'm so attracted to Union is because they really are at the kind of cutting edge of asking and, attempting to answer in their own ways, some of the most profound moral and spiritual questions about gender, about sexuality, about race, about notions of belonging. I personally believe that all of our faiths, all of the world's religions, all forms of spirituality have something to offer to the debate and conversation about whether we want to be a punitive nation that is known for locking up and deporting unprecedented numbers of people, or whether we want to be the kind of people who have open hearts and open minds and respond first with compassion and attempt at understanding, and who see the dignity and value and divinity in all people, no matter who they are, where they came from, or what they may have done.
Listeners, you can have the conversation, as Michelle Alexander was just saying, on street corners, in classrooms, in barbershops, and here on The Brian Lehrer Show. So if you have a question or a comment for Michelle Alexander, author of the highly influential 2010 book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, now joining the Union Theological Seminary here in New York for a five-year visiting professor position, or for Union Theological Seminary President Dr. Serene Jones, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Dr. Jones, do you think historically oppressed or currently oppressed communities need to have a fundamentally different relationship to religion than people who are from more advantaged groups or individual backgrounds? Like the idea of prophetic advocacy, Michelle Alexander has referenced, focuses on the work to improve people's situations in relation to the existing power structure. We also think of religion, though, as providing an ethical framework for our individual selves, focused on our own behavior toward others. Is the balance of those different depending on your circumstances in life from your perspective as president of Union Theological Seminary?
Well, if you take a look at our own student body, and they're all students who come here because of their commitment to grassroots social change and engaging these spiritual questions, they come from all walks of life, from wealthy communities to very poor. I don't think that you can make a simplistic judgment based on where someone is in their social location with respect to the breadth and depth of their capacity for moral reflection and action. But I do think that people who experience on a day-to-day basis the crisis of suffering and are more close to the ground of its immediate impact have, by necessity, the need to make sense of that in the context of their own faith tradition. Oftentimes throughout history, faith traditions have been the place where people go to both receive solace but also encouragement and the direction that gives them the resources they need to resist. So I do think where you stand positions you differently with respect to the immediacy of the issue. But what's been so remarkable about Michelle's work is that it has had impact in African-American churches, in Latino churches, and in white churches at equal levels across the country.
And let me jump in here because your phone is kind of going in and out. You're fading in and out. I think listeners were able to hear most of that, but we're going to try to get you on a better line. But Michelle Alexander, do you want to tackle that same question?
Well, I think, you know, if we look throughout history, it's undeniable that faith and spirituality and the quest for deeper meaning has had a unique and powerfully important role in the lives of the dispossessed, you know, those who have been oppressed or excluded. The kind of faith and spirituality that was evident in, you know, the cotton fields of plantations where people were singing songs of freedom and singing spirituals as they're working, you know, under the hot sun with no pay and under the lash, it forms a different relationship. You have a different relationship to God and to a quest for meaning than you do if you are privileged and have few material worries or cares in the world. There's no doubt about it. And I also think, you know, though, that we need to be honest about the fact that many people today, including many people who are suffering, locked up, locked out, sitting in detention centers, waiting to be deported, people who are struggling to survive, having been branded a felon or criminal and can't work or denied public housing and all of the rest, that many of those people have lost faith, have lost hope. Many people question churches and the role of religion in our society today for good reason. And, you know, I will certainly not pretend that religion or churches themselves necessarily have the answers to all of the questions or even most of the questions that many people today are wrestling with in their quest for basic survival. But I think it is a mistake to imagine that these questions do not have a moral and spiritual dimension. And our politics today, if you spend 5 minutes watching, you know, pundits in the media today, you can see that our politics today are almost completely devoid of any acknowledgement of the profound kind of moral and spiritual dimension of what it means to make a nation, what it means to define who we are as a people, and that our rules and laws don't just have a function in our society for controlling people or making our lives more efficient or even making our neighborhoods safer, that our rules and laws and policies and practices reflect who we are, what we believe about ourselves and one another. And our nation
for decades has waged a brutal drug war on the poorest and most vulnerable people, denying people drug treatment, denying them jobs and access to housing once they're released, locking people permanently into a second-class status, not a few, but by the millions. And we have also responded with nothing but violence to communities who are suffering with violence. I mean, mass incarceration itself, taking people out of, you know, off the street and locking them in cages and subjecting them to the violence that is mass incarceration, rather than investing in schools, rather than investing in health care and mental health treatment. These are choices, moral choices, that have been made. They're not just questions of politics or power. And I'm grateful that Union Theological Seminary is opening their doors to people like me who want to take these questions seriously.
Troy in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Michelle Alexander and Serene Jones. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you, Brian, for taking my call. Best to your guest. I'm a huge fan of Professor Alexander's since her book, The New Jim Crow. My question is, there seems to be this lack of leadership in the black community with regard to public intellectuals, and I'd like to know, why is it that our best thinkers end up in academia or other institutions instead of being physically involved in the grassroots effort toward humanism?
Well, it's difficult for me to speak for others. You know, I can only say that for myself, my journey into academia has been sort of a strange one. It was only after kind of years of working as a civil rights lawyer and advocate and doing coalition building and grassroots organizing that I went into academia because I was concerned that so many of the people who were engaged in social justice and racial justice work weren't prioritizing the crisis of mass incarceration. In fact, weren't really treating it as or human rights issue at all. And so, you know, my own journey into academia kind of began, in advocacy. But I think that the reality is, you know, many people who want to, you know, write or speak about issues that are deeply meaningful to them don't necessarily know where to go other than in academia, a place that where you can make a living and be paid to write and to publish and to speak. And frankly, many people who are academics don't necessarily have skills as grassroots organizers or advocates and therefore imagine that they can make their best contribution in academia, teaching in classrooms or writing. So I can't speak for others, but what I can say is that I agree wholeheartedly that people who are speaking about and writing about the most pressing issues of our time ought to be connected in a meaningful way to not only those who are experiencing, who are most impacted by these issues and by these crises, but also, you know, connected to and engaged in a meaningful way with those who are working to make a way out of no way.
Greg,
I really thank you for your question.
Greg on Long Island in Babylon. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
All right, so from my understanding, I had heard that Hillary Clinton years ago had passed a bill for mass incarceration along with other congressmen or women, but also I also heard that there was a former police chief that was fired or removed from the force that had been telling officers to target minorities in the city as far as ticketing and making arrests. And I also have one other statement to make, and I think that we all forget this, but we're all human beings and we're all brothers and sisters trying to live and have good lives in our communities. And as a white person, I'd say, you know, looking back through history, I'm somewhat envious of the black communities because no matter how many struggles they go through, they always seem to come together as a community and as a family. And uplift themselves where the state fails them or any kind of benefits that the state could give them won't. So I don't know, anything that you could say about those things.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting that you have that perception about the Black community, or even have a feeling of envy for, you know, the ability of the community to come together in this way. I would invite you to read my book if you have time or have interest and inclination, because one of the things I wanted to do in writing that book was to expose how mass incarceration and the Get Tough movement and the war on drugs has decimated communities of color, you know, especially impoverished Black communities, not only by locking up people en masse, but by destroying, family connections, destroying networks that existed in communities, by turning, you know, people against each other, forcing family members to testify against other family members, mothers losing their children, fathers who aren't able to see children because the only time they can see them is through glass, at the jail waiting room or visiting room, or when people are locked up hundreds of miles away. The capacity of the African American community to come together to challenge this latest form of racial and social control has been badly, badly damaged by the fact that the system itself tears families and communities apart and pits us against one another. And so, yes, there is a beautiful spirit that exists within the African American community of resilience and of perseverance, and of love, a revolutionary love and spirit that continues to exist. But what you may see from a distance is a community coming together, I think, may be somewhat misguided. Our communities are far more damaged and are struggling to come together in the wake of mass incarceration.
Interesting. Well, that could start a whole other long conversation. How much yes, how much no? I just want to follow up briefly, and we're going to run out of time soon, but there's one other caller who I want to get on to with a question for Dr. Jones. But following up on the first part of Greg's question about Hillary Clinton and mass incarceration. Some of our listeners no doubt read your scathing article against Hillary Clinton's candidacy in The Nation back last winter when the primaries were in full swing, based largely on both Clinton's contributions to mass incarceration. And that was in the context of the primaries against Bernie Sanders. I'm just curious, are you planning to vote for Clinton for president?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that, you know, I guess understandably we're a month or so away from Election Day. There is, you know, sort of a frenzy of, you know, concern and intention about who are you going to vote for? Are you voting for Hillary? Will you cast a protest vote? What? And, you know, I just have to say that I think what is far more important than who we vote for on Election Day is what we do the day after, no matter who is elected. And so I think, you know, there is in the media often a tendency to create almost a circus-like environment around presidential elections in particular, but, you know, in the electoral process in general. And my absolute commitment is to building a long-term movement for racial and social justice that will bring an end to mass incarceration and to mass deportation, and that will birth a new America no matter who is elected. And, you know, I hope that, you know, no matter what happens on Election Day, that people don't throw their hands up in despair if Trump is elected and say, it's all over now, you know, Armageddon has come, fall into a pit of disillusionment and despair, but instead will commit themselves to working harder and with more boldness and courage, and that they will do the same thing if Hillary Clinton is elected. That if Hillary Clinton is elected, we will not either throw up our hands in despair or throw up our hands rejoicing, imagining that an incredible victory has occurred, but instead ask ourselves, are we willing to act with more boldness and courage and commit ourselves to movement building in a variety of forms to build a new America? The work for us the day after the election, remains. And so that's why I have been reluctant to, you know, join in these frenzied debates about this election, which is not to deny its significance.
So certainly that was a great statement. And certainly this show agrees and is committed to treating democracy as so much more than the isolated act of going to a polling place and casting a vote. And yet, here we are. Are you going to vote for Clinton? Did we just lose Michelle? Do you want
to? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. My call must have been dropped.
Oh, you're back.
Yeah.
Oh, I was asking you, despite the profundity and importance of what you just said about democracy being so much more than elections, here we are with a choice to make. So will you say who you're going to vote for?
Yeah, I certainly am not voting for Trump. And to be honest with you, it's going to take a lot of deep reflection for me to decide what I'm doing on Election Day. And I encourage everyone to do the same. So, I am deeply concerned about Trump being elected, and I live in a swing state. I live in Ohio, where Trump is leading right now, and I have to say that it's a conversation that I've been having with my children and my friends, and I've decided, you know, to not speak publicly about that issue and to make my decision on Election Day.
Dr. Jones, president of the Union Theological Seminary, I'll give you the last word here. Why do you think religious politics have become so associated with the right? We say the religious right. Very few people say the religious left, even though it does exist. It's just not as commonly known a term. And if you look at surveys of the voting tendencies or the political affiliations of people who tend to attend religious services on a very regular basis, they tend to be more conservative. How did religion give up on progressivism, or how did progressivism give up on religion?
Well, two things to say about that. One, I think if you actually look at the statistics of all of the mainline liberal traditions across Roman Catholic, Protestant, Pentecostal, Evangelical, and categorize them theologically and politically, the liberal number would far outweigh the conservative Evangelical. But as a single block, it is a powerful block. But I think part of what we're seeing in this election is a huge crack running through the middle of Evangelical America, in that people are being asked really to struggle with what matters to them more, their whiteness or their evangelicalness. And we're seeing the degree to which being evangelical has been collapsed into a set of white supremacist political theological categories, and has itself lost its theological bearings.
Dr. Serene Jones is president of the Union Theological Seminary. She is welcoming to the faculty for a five-year visiting professorship Michelle Alexander, the civil rights lawyer and legal scholar and author of the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the literary legend, Tom Wolfe. Stay with us. And we'll be live on Facebook with Tom Wolfe, so get yourselves ready for that. We'll be streaming this with video on Facebook Live, so go there and watch us, or just stay there and listen to us.